Welcome to the Law Shit You Should Know podcast. We're here to talk a little bit about the law
and a whole lot about nothing. Every week, we have a new guest to discuss current events, legal drama, and dive even deeper into
the Law Shit You Should Know.
All right, welcome back to Law Shit You Should Know with Alina Santana.
And Leslie Marenko.
And the amazing David Batchelder joining us today. Hi, David.
Hi.
How you doing?
Doing great.
Thank you for joining us.
Certainly.
Why don't we start by telling everyone a little bit about who you are and what you do?
Sure. My name is Dave Batchelder, and I do Social Security disability and SSI disability applications, appeals, and overpayments.
And we were just saying, there aren't many of you, David. I mean, there's, you know, out of the 120,000 of us, I think, in Florida,
there's
tons of, you know, family law attorneys, estate planning attorneys, immigration attorneys. You can't throw a rock without hitting them, especially here in Coral Gables. But it's kind of hard to find one of you that deals with this area of law.
It is.
It seems like a dying breed. I've been practicing in this area of law for 32 years.
A dying breed.
It's a dying breed, I think, simply because it's Social Security Administration has it's really turned into a very hostile environment, and it wasn't like this when I first started practicing in 1992. The intent of the act was supposed to be for everyone to be looking out for the disabled working person, the person that's worked and paid into the system, and then as the years have gone by, I've just seen it grow more and more hostile as an agency, more and more hostile with the local office representatives, the state agency reps, even the judges that we deal with. So,
do you think that's a product of politics? Do you think it's a product of just people being sick with the system? Do you think it's why do you think that's changed so much?
That's a good question.
You don't.
I don't have the answer for that. We have ebbs and flows there, and the system was, I remember back in the late 90s, early 2000s, the system was inundated with applications, and it got to the point where it was over 2 years to get a hearing date in front of the judge.
Wow. For like a disability claim.
Right.
How do you survive all that time?
Good question. How do you survive? It's probably the most common question that I get asked from prospective clients, current clients. What am I going to do? How am I going to survive? And without trying to sound like a wise ass, my standard go-to response is always, I don't know. What are you going to do? I don't have the wherewithal, the means to support you for the next 3 years while we go through this bureaucratic maze. Battle the bureaucracy, right? And so people that are fortunate enough and have had the foresight and the wherewithal to purchase private long-term disability insurance benefits, of course, a lot of people fall back on that.
Sure.
Exhaust their savings, sell their house, end up on their mother's couch, end up living under the bridge. I have clients that literally live under the bridge. And communicate with them with a P.O. box. So that's what it's turned into. I don't know if that's what it's turned into. It's always been that way. As a society, we don't do a very good job of taking care of people who need it the most, in my opinion. And the Social Security system, although the intent was not to provide for everything, the fact that it's so broken now is really an eyesore on the system as a whole and on the agency, I think. COVID really broke the agency.
Interesting. It sounds like it was broken before, though.
I guess when people wax nostalgic about the good old days, here are some examples of how COVID really, really broke the agency. Initially, it was 4 to 6 months when start to finish, file an application for disability benefits. The way the process works, you file an application either online or go to the Social Security office and file the application with the local Social Security office. It's then forwarded to the state agency that's responsible for developing the claim and making a decision on the case. And that state agency is called the Office of Disability Determinations, or Disability Determination Services. Mm-hmm.
DDS?
DDS.
DDS, okay.
And it's a subset of the Florida State Department of Health and Human Services.
Okay.
So that the Social Security Administration, the agency contracts with the state agency.
I was about to say, I'm already confused because right. Social Security is all federal, but now we're talking about something that lives under an umbrella under Florida law.
Right, and each individual state is the same. It's the same.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
So the federal agency contracts with the local state agency. So you have DDS, Tallahassee, Miami, Orlando, Tampa, all over the place. And initially, before COVID, you could set your watch by 4 to 6 months to process an initial application start to finish. It's now 18 months.
Oof. The initial application.
Initial application. The initial application is now 18 months because if you don't have something that would qualify as dire need, so stage 4 cancer, end-stage renal disease, all the big ones, right?
Wow.
If you're not red flagged initially for that, if you're just a construction worker that blew out his back and had a bad surgery and never was never able to bounce back and can't work anymore, you're going to sit in line for the next 12 months. You're going to go to backlog for 12 months before it's then assigned to the medical adjudicator who takes the 4 to 6 months to render the decision.
That it's
so
always
that's,
taken.
That's the backlog right there, right? 12 months. And so now it's 18 months. And as recent as a year and a half ago, they were telling us, they were telling us that they recognize that the backlog is their first priority, their biggest problem, and they're gonna dedicate all kinds of resources and manpower to that backlog. But I haven't seen it.
Now, excellent.
To their credit, they did say it's going to get worse before it gets better. You know, right? And quite frankly, I haven't seen any worse than 18 months. In one select case, I have that went on for 2 years.
And you said this is post-COVID. Is this because they stopped processing during COVID, or they were just overwhelmed?
Well, it wasn't a question of more cases. Mm-hmm. They were subject to the great resignation or the great retirement like everybody else mm-hmm. was. So you've got people working from home. And the funny part is, this all I can tell you is what I'm seeing, right? I don't have any facts or figures all this up, but here's what I can tell you. State agency level went from 4 to 6 months to 18 months to process an initial application. Working from home, it was impossible to get these people on the phone unless they wanted to talk to you, and then they're blowing up your phone at 8 o'clock at night on a random Wednesday, right?
Yeah. This sounds like immigration.
Right? So you can't get through to anybody. There's nobody available because they're all working from home. I don't know if they're working from home or they're walking the dog, but you couldn't.
Exactly.
You couldn't get anybody on the phone to process these things. And then when it comes down to it, when they all start going back to work, you notice that we're dealing with a lot of new names now. We used to know all the medical adjudicators. Now we're dealing with a lot of new names. So they mm-hmm. either retired or because they don't pay these people a lot of money.
Right.
So they either retired or went on to something else because they didn't want to go back to the office. They were happy from working from home. Mm-hmm. But they had to go back to the office. And so that state agency level really got broken. Now, to the judge's credit, and I'd be the first to admit, before COVID, I didn't really have a lot of good things to say about a lot of judges, a few mm-hmm. select judges that I really respect. But I don't know how they did it. But since we were able to do hearings by telephone and video, the judges got their backlog reduced from, say, a year and a half to get a hearing date. I get a hearing date in 4 to 6 months all day long now.
Nice.
So it kind of flipped.
It totally flipped. So the judges did a great job handling the backlog and actually eliminated the backlog because 4 to 6 months,
it's not that bad
for a hearing date. And so, I can't say enough good things about the judges. Now, my concern is, we're still being pushed for telephone hearings, online hearings. I want to be in court.
Yeah.
Even though these are bench trials, I consider myself a litigator. I think we're all better off if my client is standing face-to-face against the judge or opposing counsel or whatever. You're better off in court, right?
I hear you. I live in right? bench trial world and administrative court, and I 100% agree with right. you. There's still something to be said for the demeanor of the person, how they come across, whether you believe them, their credibility, frankly. I think there's a lot to be said, and I'm with you. If anything, right. I think I'm more of a litigator because I have to convince a judge instead of a jury,
exactly.
which is yep. harder, frankly, yep. sometimes.
And it's scary now because they have been pushing us for online and video hearings for years and mm-hmm. years, and they were setting up national hearing centers. So Big mm. Brother is alive and well. Right? And pushing you for national hearing centers where it'll be more efficient and we'll get you better time frames and et cetera, et cetera. But I can guarantee you that if I'm dealing with an ALJ in Chicago, they don't, I can say stuff like this, they don't give a rat's ass about somebody that's going to get health care at Jackson because
right.
they don't know what Jackson is. So you can't really communicate with the National Hearing Center in Chicago when they don't understand our people here in Miami.
Right.
And so now when I go, again, the scary part is we have in-person hearings now, but I think I'm one of two or three that actually do in-person hearings still. I go to hearings, there's nobody there.
Wow.
It used to be packed with attorneys and claimants and everybody getting their hearings done in court. There's nobody there anymore.
That's because people can still elect into
telephone and video.
Got it.
And most attorneys elect into it.
Right. And who wants to deal with Miami traffic at 8:30 a.m. for
yeah,
a
8:30
hearing?
I
right?
hear that.
And my hearings are in the same building as yours.
Right? Yeah.
You
know, I'm actually aware of that. I know right. the address by memory.
Yeah. I'm on the 8th floor. I'm on
you
the
have the
floor,
the, so. The 8th floor, and we have 1 through 7, basically.
Right.
Yeah.
yeah. So
same building. Yeah.
It's
parking is atrocious and expensive.
Well, $20.
It's $20 cash.
cash.
Don't forget.
Cash.
Oh yeah.
Cash.
It has been more than one occasion where I have forgotten to bring cash and then I end up walking 5 blocks to get cash to be
uh-huh.
able to pay for the parking lot next to the courthouse.
Yeah. I used to park in that parking lot and then they booted me one time and I was so pissed off I said I'll never go there ever again.
Oh wow.
And I knew the guy too. I mean, if I had early morning hearings, I'd have to show up early.
Yeah.
And there's nobody there. So
yeah.
there's nobody to pay. So I'd pay the guy on my way
out. On
up.
Your way out, yeah.
And since I didn't pay and it was the hearing ran over, they booted my car.
Really?
So I had to pay for the boot and the parking. And so I said, from now on, I'm paying the $20 cash at the garage.
Oh, wow. That's crazy.
They weren't.
It's
nice.
And it's only $20 for the first 4 hours. If you
right.
go over 4 hours, it becomes $40. I learned that the hard way one day as well, because I didn't know that since I had never been there more than 4 hours. But
yeah.
Definitely learned that. Anyways, yes, the fun parking lot in the Immigration and Social Security building.
Yep.
So this first part where you get in front of the examiner, and now it's taken 18 months.
But that's not the first part, right? Isn't that like at the very end? Or
no,
is
that's
that,
the initial application.
That's the initial application
and
for
so
disability, though.
Right.
I have heard this rumor that everybody gets denied.
67% get denied.
That everybody, you file an application, you're getting denied, right?
67%. So
67%.
2 out of 3.
That number has stayed the same for the last 32 years that
so
I've
So, like,
practiced.
How fucked up do you got to be, David, for them not to deny your application?
Or...
That's terrible.
Or,
I mean...
Or do you have to be represented by me?
Sure.
Because we have a 92% pay rate.
Right. Well, for sure, be represented by David.
I cannot help but ask this, though. If it's so consistently
67%, right.
consistently over what, 30 years, you said?
32 years.
For 32 years, it's been exactly 67%. This screams to me, yes, no, no, yes, no, no, yes, no, no. I mean, that's how that feels to me. Like, there's a quota, almost, and it's not actually that independent. Or this
right.
one's got an attorney, sure, that one doesn't, no. Like, is that, I mean, I know they wouldn't publish that, but is that what you feel goes on? Or you actually think it's just coincidence that it's been 67% for 32 years?
Obviously, it's not coincidence. And I don't live behind the scenes, so I can't tell
yeah.
you what really happens. But
right.
I do remember a 60 Minutes episode that was done a year or 2 years ago where they actually interviewed people that worked at the state agency who admitted that, yes, I can't really say it, but there are a certain amount of cases that I'm
that have to be denied.
That I'm encouraged to
mm-hmm. right.
certain numbers that we're not trained on how to pay cases.
Right.
And the funny part is
we're trained on how to deny them. That's
right,
terrible.
Right. And way back in the day, in my early days practicing, there was a judge in Virginia who told me that they had the state agency medical adjudicators had a quota, and he could tell me that because he was retiring. And his wife was also retiring, and she was a state agency examiner, and he knew that there were only a certain amount of cases that they were allowed to approve. And so, I mean, the numbers speak for themselves, right? 67% across the board, nationwide.
For 32 years.
Over two-thirds. For two, and what
it's
is it?
It's too perfect.
Or it goes up to 68. It goes down to 63. It's two-thirds.
It's two-thirds.
And then at reconsideration, your first appeal, 88%. 88% get denied.
Ooh.
Oh, wow.
So it is.
So make sure you have an attorney the first time around, because it only gets worse later.
Yeah.
Basically.
Yeah.
So, sorry, back to your question about.
So what is the standard? I mean, I trip and fall and break a leg and it has to get amputated. I don't know, whatever. And so now I can't work anymore. Let's say I am the construction worker.
It better be amputated above the knee, because below the knee you don't get anything. I mean, get anything. Your prosthesis has to be. It can't fit, and it's going to be painful if you're going to think you're going to have an argument for that.
Interesting.
To answer your question, the standard is the inability to engage in any substantial gainful activity.
Any
substantial gainful activity. So let's stop there. Usually I dumb it down for my clients, and I say the inability to work. But it's not the inability to work. It's the inability to engage in substantial gainful activity. Substantial gainful activity defined as any work for pay or profit where you gross more than $1,550 a month. So if you make more than $1,550 a month, and if you're still working and have all these medical impairments, you're kicked out at step one.
Which is what, like $22,000 a year or something like that, give or take? I mean, I'm doing...
And I can also tell you this, that even if you think that you can work part-time and still still be entitled to Social Security disability, forget about it. I know what the law says. There's no way in hell that case is getting paid. It's certainly not getting paid at the initial application stage.
Right.
Because I hate to say things like this, but they really don't have the insight, I don't know how well the training is, but try having a conversation with a medical adjudicator about somebody that's not engaging in substantial gainful activity. They're working. They're making $800 a month. It's not SGA, but they're working. And so step one is, are they working? No, step one is, are they engaging in substantial gainful activity? Why am I having this conversation? You know why? Because it's going to get denied.
Yeah.
Right.
So that's why when I interview people, we are very, very selective about our clientele, because I'm just a very small shop. I have a paralegal that's been with me for 14 years, and what you see is what you get. That's us. It's a very small shop. I take in, on average, maybe 10 new cases a month. We are highly selective, and there can be no work activity at the initial application stage if you want to give me an opportunity to have your claim allowed at the initial application stage. If you're going to work part-time and you have to work time and I have to do it or I'm going to be on the street, I completely understand it. I'm not paying your bills, but I'm likely not representing you either, because that case has no shot if I continue to work.
Right.
Now, if you'll work with me and understand that, we may have to put this in front of a judge while you work and make $700 a month. That's different. You know, we can have that conversation.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're going to get all pissed off at me because the claim was denied 18 months later, I told you so. And so that's how draconian the standard is. But it's the inability to engage in any substantial gainful activity for a period of at least 12 months or more. So you've got to be out of work for 12 months a year. Now, you don't have to be out of work for 12 months before you file the application, because we have already seen the application is going to be 12 to 18 months, right?
Right.
So you just have to have a severe medical condition that has either kept you out of work for 12 months or is expected to keep you out of work for 12 months or result in death. Severe medical impairments, you know, the human mind, the body can fail you for a million different reasons, right?
Yeah.
So there's 14 different subsets in what they call the listing of impairments, where they've tried to address all the different things that could go with the body, wrong with the body or the mind. And so you go to the listings first. So step one is, are you working? Step two, do you have a severe impairment that meets a listing? And so you look for the listings. And again,
because those have been predetermined to be approvable, basically.
Right,
okay,
right,
got it.
Right. There are what they call medically determinable impairments. And that medically determinable impairment, again, there's a, you know, Social Security's listings will tell you all the different things that you have to have, that you have to prove for at least 12 months or more, mm-hmm, in order to qualify for a listing. So
I feel like I have to ask about mental issues at this point, because I feel like the physical ones are easier to prove with your medical records. What about,
sure,
people with mental disabilities? And I don't mean like from birth. I mean, you know, you develop, I don't know, I'm trying to think of something. You have some strokes and your cognition has gone,
right,
down.
Right.
And those you're not completely gone, but you have some loss of processing, some cognition,
right,
issues.
Sure.
How do you go about, like, what do they have, a checklist? Like,
yes.
There's a test of, I mean,
it's under listing 12.00, anxiety, depression, schizophrenia,
yeah,
cognitive impairments.
Like, how do you prove your depression is so bad that you can't work?
Very good question. Well,
because I believe like half our society is officially either anxious or depressed or
Everybody's bipolar.
Everyone's got an issue in this society. Okay,
like, you prove that case the same exact way you prove any other physical case. You get the gold standard are medical opinions from treating sources.
Right.
So, of course, in the last 32 years, we have interrogatories that we've developed that address every conceivable way that you could be disabled, hopefully.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so we have our own evaluation forms. The gold standard, you have a long treating source, even better, a long treating specialist, PhD psychologist,
yeah,
MD psychiatrist, that has treated you for a while, so you've established treating physician status,
mm-hmm,
and is willing to support your claim for benefits, meaning they're willing to complete an evaluation on your behalf, and they're willing to indicate, there's two different ways. I have an evaluation that lists all the different things in the listings, and then you have to have at least two marked impairments or one extreme impairment. So ability to interact appropriately with other people, marked or extreme. Maintain your attention, concentration, persistence, pace, marked or extreme. And those are terms
and
of art,
of course.
And do they
just take the word of the psychiatrist who marks the box?
No, those opinions,
yeah,
even those opinions, if we're, I would say, lucky enough, we're not lucky, because I require all my clients to approach their doctors ahead of time before I even undertake representation. They have to take this evaluation form to their treating doctor and say, can you help me? I've spoken to an attorney. He may or may not take my case. It all depends on you. If you're willing to support me, he'll take my case and he'll represent me. I take myself out of the equation. We don't do depots. We don't do doctor statements. These benefits are very limited. It's,
mm-hmm,
not a multi-million-dollar medical malpractice case.
Right,
right,
right.
Maximum federal benefit rate is $3,676 a month. That's for the high earners. So $3,600 a month. Maybe another $1,800 if you've got auxiliary beneficiaries 18 or under.
Mm-hmm.
But these are limited recoveries. So we try to stay very, very tight when it comes to the expenses and the case costs. One of the ways that I've found that it's even more successful, give that evaluation form to your client. They tell you they've got a good relationship with their doctor. They present it to their doctor, will you help me? Of course I will. I've been telling you to file for disability for 3 years now.
Right.
And they fill it out. That's the best case scenario.
Yeah.
The doctor says, another evaluation form, I don't fill those out. Go see a physical therapist. You know, you get that too. But they get the opinions. Fantastic. That's the gold standard. Yes, I'll take your case. Now, those opinions have to be consistent with and supported by the doctor's treatment notes. So if the doctor's talking about
like past treatment notes, like historical,
past, present, future, because the claimant has the burden of proving ongoing disability right up to the date of the decision.
Mm-hmm.
So if the prior treatment notes say they're sunny, dancing on the rainbow every day and there are no issues,
sure,
we've got problems with marked and extreme limitations of function, right?
Uh-huh. So, but like, you can't get better.
Yes, you can.
Like your medication is making you better. I mean, very few doctors I know would not say there's this improvement in this area.
Waxes and wanes.
Right. I mean, especially that's normal, right?
Especially with medical impairments, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Especially with mental impairments. What, yes. You know, I could get 2 or 3 months where they say, oh, that medication's really working.
100%,
I'm sleeping so much better. And then, again, if somebody has severe mental issues,
yes, yeah,
then more times than not, it's going to go up, it's going to go down.
Correct.
Because this person has been dealing with this for years now.
100%.
And trying to work, and then finally it all bottoms out. Now, if they do get to the point where they've improved and they can go back to work, then we can still pursue a closed period of disability if they've been out of work for at least 12 months or more.
And that's what, retroactive disability?
And then you're pursuing the retroactive benefits.
Interesting.
You pursue the back pay on their behalf.
And the government will pay you back pay for something that's no longer. So that's interesting, because you said the wait time is like 18 months.
Right.
So when you get granted at the end of 18 months, are they also getting back pay all that wait time?
Yes, except for the first 5 months. So you don't get paid for the first 5 months. Why? I don't know.
That's a very specific number.
That's the law. I tell my clients, what do you mean I don't get paid for the first 5 months?
You ever seen Judge Dredd? I am the law.
Yeah, I don't know. It's just why they came up with this. Why do you wait 29 months for Medicare? Because it's a 24-month wait period for Medicare plus the 5 months for wait period for the SSDI. So you have to be disabled for 5 months before they have to start paying you anything. That's when the retroactive benefits start accruing. Also, something to consider when they apply, if they tell me, yeah, I haven't worked in 2 years, I've been out of work, I've been disabled for 2 years. The maximum they can pay you, the maximum is 1 year prior to the application date. So sometimes that factors in with a 5 month wait period or not. But there has recently been some legislation introduced or some bills, bantied around, about eliminating the wait, eliminating the 5 months, eliminating the Medicare wait. But it's, you know, that's, they've been talking about that forever.
Sure, sure, sure.
And you know, why? I don't know.
You know, Dave, I explained to my clients that certain types of immigration, like marriage-based immigration, has gotten harder, even though the standard hasn't changed, technically, legally speaking,
right,
because of all the fraud that was going on. Do you feel that happens in your system? Because I feel like it's ripe for someone trying to take advantage of it.
The answer is no. I don't think fraud has anything to do with it. I know that I belong to a national organization, National Organization of Social Security Claimants Representatives, NOSCR. And I've been a member of NOSCR since I first started practicing in 1992. And I've always been amazed, and I could find it for you if it's, I know I could find it for you, less than 1% of all claims.
Really?
Involves fraud.
Interesting.
And they have been, they've been really, really good about trying to send that message out, because there's always this preconceived notion.
There is. It's absolutely preconceived.
That fraud is rampant in the Social Security disability system. That thing that happened in Kentucky some years ago didn't help that.
What happened in Kentucky?
There was an attorney who had a couple reps in the local Social Security office paid off, and he had a judge in his pocket, and
good old fashioned bribery.
Yeah, reps and a judge. Yeah. I mean, that guy went above and beyond. You sure he's not from Miami?
Here's the funny part. His name was Eric Kahn.
Right? Oh, God.
So Kahn had a huge mill in Kentucky, and big TV advertising firm. And everybody got paid if you're represented by Eric Kahn.
No, I assume this is jurisdictional, right? Like, I can't call Eric Kahn from Miami, Florida, and be like, I really want you to be my lawyer, buddy, and let's process my stuff in Kentucky, correct?
No, okay. He can represent you in Miami.
In Miami.
I can represent anyone in any state in the United States, because it's federal administrative law.
Sure, like me. Interesting. Yeah. Okay.
So, I actually did know local that. Precinct, so to speak, not Leslie's process.
Yeah, it's
process.
Based on the zip code of the client, I assume, just like me.
Exactly.
Yeah, same thing for me. We fly around everywhere, and
Before I got married and had kids, I used to use it as an excuse to travel. So I've done.
That's me. I make a weekend out of it.
Right? I've been here in San Diego. New
yes.
York,
yeah, me too.
Key West as often as I could.
It was so fun. I was always the first to volunteer for these trips.
Yeah. But he could do your case here, but it would have to be his.
Not with his judge. He wouldn't be interested. Not in Miami.
Well, he can't do it. He's in jail now.
Oh, well. Right.
But yeah, I do feel like this is then you've made it clear to me that it's a myth. But I feel like this is what's talked about so much about all the fake disability claims.
Well, and you know what else? There's less and less of it now.
Interesting.
Because it's been my experience that thieves are lazy people.
Okay.
I mean, this does seem like a lot of work for some $3,000 a month.
Yeah, I mean, we said almost 40K maximum, right?
I was going to say, we could probably, orchestrate one of these fake car accidents and make more money here, David, here in Miami.
Think about that for a minute. If thieves are lazy people, are they going to go through all the paperwork, all the time,
all
the telephone conferences, all the appeals, all of that for... I said the maximum federal benefit amount is $3,676 a month. The average blue-collar American worker, $1,573. So for $1,500 a month, you going to go through all this for all this time?
If you're an industrious fraudster, you're going to find something else to do.
So there's actually been less and less fraud now with the agency the way it is. So,
and has that number gone up over the years?
I
assume for inflation, no? Every year it goes up a bit, or no? The maximum that they'll grant?
Cost of living adjustment every year, yes.
Okay, so cost of living adjustment.
There were 2 years where there was no cost of living adjustment, where we were trying to recover from Bush Cheney and President Obama put a hold on cost of living adjustments for 2 years, and then President Biden came in and made up for it, and it gave him a huge...
I think it was 8% or something,
huge
wasn't it?
Cost of living adjustment.
I just looked this up.
So there's a COLA each year for, unless something specific prevents it, there's a COLA each year.
Interesting. So we talked a lot about disability. Can we go talk about Social Security benefits for a little bit?
Okay. So... I thought we were talking about the same thing.
Well, we are, but I want to talk about all these acronyms, right? So SSI versus SSDI, can you explain to the listeners and to us what's the difference?
I can do that.
Yeah, yes. Okay. That's what I meant.
Okay, so SSI is Supplemental Security Income Disability Benefits.
Okay.
SSDI, Social Security Disability Insurance Benefits. SSI, Social Welfare Program for the Neediest. Living below the poverty threshold, same definition, same criteria for disability. So the disability standard is the same.
Okay.
SSI is classic social safety net. You have no money. You can have a car, but only one. You can have a house, but only one. And no more than $2,000 in the bank. But don't have $2,000 in the bank because they're going to take away for every dollar.
So SSDI, you have... more in assets and benefits. Is
SSDI,
that what you're saying?
You can have whatever you want because SSDI is a long-term disability insurance program.
Okay.
That you've paid into. You think you're paying in for your retirement benefits, right? FICA, Medicare, you're paying for your Social Security retirement.
Mm-hmm.
Except I was in a horrible accident or I contracted a terrible disease and now I can't work anymore. So the money you've paid in rolls over into a disability insurance benefits fund.
Okay. And SSI has nothing to do with what you've paid in and everything to do with just your, like you said, welfare level, basically.
Right. You haven't paid anything in. You know, it doesn't matter. And that's why children below 18 can still get SSI.
Right.
But their parents' income are imputed to them. So that gets a little tricky.
Interesting. And it's the same process that you were describing before. So you have a hearing first and then go from there.
Right. It's exactly the same. But the hearing is last.
Right. Okay. The application.
Application, state agency. If you get denied, you request reconsideration back to the same state agency. God's own private mystery how long it's going to take. And I don't say that lately. I get some back in 90 days. That used to be the standard, like clockwork, 90 days for a recon decision, because if there hasn't been any kind of significant worsening or something, they're just going to rubber stamp it and get it out. Now it could be a year. for recon, and God knows why, or 8 months, a year, I don't know why. But if you get denied at recon, then you request a hearing to get your case in front of an ALJ.
And then once an ALJ denies it, is there an even higher up appellate process?
One more level of administrative review, that's the Appeals Council.
Okay.
In Baltimore, used to be Falls Church, Virginia.
Oh, so same as us, years. Falls yeah. Church, Virginia, right? The Board of Immigration Appeals. Yeah. This all these administrative agencies. Falls Church,
it's in
Virginia.
Baltimore now. Appeals Council, 88% denial rate with the Appeals Council. And then you've exhausted all your administrative remedies, and now you go into federal court.
Is that 88% also consistent for 32 years?
A little bit. Okay, up, all right. Pretty much.
Okay, yeah, all right. But not as exact on the 2/3.
Yeah, they're not real thrilled about overturning other ALJs.
It's the same.
You have to prove errors of law. You're not arguing facts.
Yeah, I mean, I was just going to say, every time you appeal this to another level, or you get to another level, I mean, the facts are the same. Are you allowed to supplement with, look, in the last 4 months, as we've been waiting for an appeal, he's even more messed up. I mean, are you allowed to?
I mean, generally not in my world. Can you
all
supplement?
All factual. This seems all like...
You can't, you're not supposed to, but I do it anyway.
Oh, same.
I do it anyway.
And then you get a decision telling you how the evidence you submitted was irrelevant, but in my head, I'm still persuading you.
Right, exactly.
I'm still messing with your head.
You never know. Something that pops up and
whose
it catches
heart
their
you
attention.
Moved. I'm really. With you. I'm totally
it
with you.
It catches their attention. or if it used to be way back in the good old days, right? It used to be you could submit evidence right up to the day of the hearing.
Yeah.
Right up to the day the Appeals Council makes the decision. You could submit supplemental evidence. And you're required to because you're the claimant. You have the burden of proof. Now, all evidence has to be submitted within 5 days of the hearing. And if not, you have to send a letter telling them all evidence is not in. And then you can submit the evidence.
Yep.
But at the Appeals Council, the record is closed before the ALJ, and they won't consider any new evidence unless there are certain exceptions. So again, I submit it anyway because I found that when you go to federal court, they want to know, wait a minute, why didn't they consider this evidence? This is really good stuff. Oh, it didn't relate back to the period of disability. Yes, it did. I made sure there was language in that report that referred back to the original date of disability. So federal court seems a lot more amenable to sending this stuff back if there was evidence there that supported the claim. And then they said, no, we're not going to look at it.
That's basically my world, too. Ours is 15 days prior to the hearing, actually. 15 days prior to hearing or a motion to accept the late filing where you have to convince them that there's some special reason. And same thing. No evidence after the trial, but we send if there's something really compelling, we'll send it in anyways. And you never know whose heart you're going to move. But after our Board of Immigration Appeals, so yours is the AC, the Appeals Council, AC. After that, do you go to circuit court like we do or is that the end of your world?
Yeah, it's district court, right?
District court first. So interesting. No, we go straight to the 11th Circuit.
Oh, do you?
Yeah, there's no district court jump there.
Oh,
we go
right.
from the Board of Immigration Appeals straight to the circuit court.
Yeah, we go to...
So you go to district court.
Southern District.
Interesting.
Yeah. And so I'm licensed in the Southern District, Middle District. I don't do much work at all in the Northern District anymore. So it's just
interesting.
Southern District and Middle District.
That's really interesting. Now for us, there are other things we do in district court, like mandamus actions and some other things we do in district court, but not that. Like once the immigration judge gives a decision and it goes up to the Board of Immigration Appeals, it goes straight to the 11th Circuit. Like it considers it almost like the Board of Immigration Appeals was already at a higher level.
And to their credit, again, I'll give these guys all the credit in the world, the district court level. They have done a great job, I'm not going to say of fast-tracking things, but organizing it all. There was a time where they got inundated with federal court appeals because we were all just sick of it.
Yeah.
Everything was being denied. And so, you know what? We'll take everything up to federal court.
Yeah, yeah.
And it got to a point where, I can't remember the years, they're all blending in now, but it got to the point where federal court, it was just a deluge. They were just getting pummeled with disability appeals, and they ended up setting up different local rules and procedural rules to help fast track and organize the Social Security disability cases.
Interesting.
And very strict timelines, time frames, because the agency has to provide transcript, mm-hmm. right? They have to provide the transcript. And so that transcript now has to be provided in conjunction with their answer mm-hmm. to our complaint. And it's 30 days, mostly. Sometimes it's 60 days for your motion for summary judgment, your brief. But most times I'm seeing orders now, scheduling orders of 30 days.
Yeah.
They're really pushing them.
You know, Dave, I've got to ask you about money because I'm sitting here. Were you wondering the same thing?
Well, I actually had a question, but my next question after this question
was going to be about money. Because I'm sitting here and I'm hearing a lot of the things I go through as far as like litigating on a bench trial, which is like Wild Wild West. Prior to that, we're talking about applications. We're talking about dealing with experts.
And
we're talking about reports.
You've also mentioned like, well, I have to be very careful about what case I take.
And the maximum is going to be like $40K on a really, really good professional case. So how do you get paid?
Like, you mean $40K a year in benefits?
Yes.
Yeah, like, this isn't a personal injury case where at the end of the day,
after
all
you get like
effort,
$20 million.
Yeah.
Congrats, hurrah.
Right.
You know, like,
right.
And you're getting a third of that. But
I get 25%.
25%
of
25%. Okay, 25% of the retroactive benefits.
Okay,
and they cap the fee at
$7,200.
They cap the fee at $7,200.
Yeah. Now we're getting.
Oh, I see why we have to be very picky about.
Yeah. And so you've got two approaches to this thing, right? You've got TV advertising firms.
Yeah.
Whose names will not be mentioned.
Right.
Refuse to give them any additional advertising credit. TV advertising firms, and that's how I started. I started working for two big
a mill, as I call it,
big
a
mills.
Mill.
Yeah, that's I did comp, Social Security,
volume,
right?
Volume.
You take everything that comes in, and you know, throw it up against the wall and hope it sticks. And you get a shit reputation with the judges you practice in front of. And I did that for the first 4 years of my. First 4 years of my career with two different firms. And then in March 1, 1999, when I opened my own shop, I decided I'm going to take an altogether different approach. Every case has to pay. Every case has to be a viable disability case.
Uh-huh.
And I'm going
mm-hmm.
to develop that reputation such that when the judge sees my name on the letterhead, if they don't see it at first, they're going to take a second look because they know I vet my clients relentlessly at the outset.
Right.
You'd be amazed at how many judges just don't give a shit about the fact that I've got four evaluations from four treating sources that all support this case. And it's not consistent. It's not credible. It's not supported by the records. Oh, really? They have no idea how difficult it is to convince a doctor to complete this form for free.
Yes.
Right,
I'm not paying for it.
Oh, Jesus, yes.
I'm not paying for it. To fill out the form for free
or
figure out a way to bill the insurance company. I don't know how they do it. But I have to remove myself so it's not tainted, right? Because that comes from the attorney. It's tainted. And they ask a bunch of extra questions about where did it come from and what did your attorney do. And my clients tell them, you know, can tell them all the same thing. My lawyer gave me the form. I gave it to my doctor. I sat down with my doctor. That's how we got the form. I don't pay for it. We don't cost advance a lot. We'll pay for medical records. So it's $20 here, $30 there.
Yeah.
Typical case costs, if we're really paying attention, should not exceed over $300. And that's over a course of 2.5-3 years. So we keep it real tight. And now, with access to online records and whatnot, more times than not, what we'll do is we'll get the client's username and passcode and go into the system and get the records that way. So we can try and even eliminate those costs. And again, since we vent them so relentlessly at the outset, most cases win. We have a very high success rate, as you can imagine. Now, 25% of the retroactive benefits with a $7,200 cap through the administrative law judge hearing level,
mm-hmm.
if I agree to use the fee agreement process. So there's two different ways. You can be approved your fee with a fee agreement, a standard form that they approve, where you agree to the cap.
Okay.
And theoretically, the judges just rubber stamp that with a favorable decision. If there was not a prior attorney involved, they'll rubber stamp it, attorney fee agreement approved, goes up to the payment center, and you're usually paid within about 4 to 6 weeks after the favorable decision.
The government pays you directly from the winnings.
From the retroactive
winnings. Okay.
Right.
All right.
And that's how it's supposed to go. And typically, it goes okay that way. There are only a couple different things that hold it up. If there's a workers' comp offset, that's a friggin' nightmare. If there's if there's a representative payee appointed, my clients, it's a mental case where they're not capable of managing their own funds, so they get to bring in a friend or a family member to help them. Hmm. If there's a rep payee involved, then we don't get paid until the representative payee is appointed. Things like that. And another way I can get paid, if it goes beyond the administrative law judge hearing level, I can request a flat 25%, but I have to submit a fee petition. Now, the local ALJ only has authority to approve up to $12,000. It's actually, $12,000. And so let's say my fee could be $20,000, $25,000. I've got to make that decision, right? Because it's really, really taxing, because in Miami, you're looking at 6 to 8 months for a fee petition to be approved. Fort Lauderdale,
oh my God.
Again, God knows what black hole it goes into up there. you can rest assured that fee petitions for attorneys are not their number one priority.
Right, right.
Now, I've been trashing these people a lot. I also understand, and again, respect the judges for what they do. Talk about quotas. They've got to do 80 cases a month.
Wow.
That's 20 a week.
Ooh.
That's pre-hearing review. That's holding the hearing. Post-hearing review. Write the decision. Get it out the door.
That's four a day, basically, Monday to Friday.
That's a lot of work.
80 cases
that's
a month. And if they can do that, then they can work from home a couple days a week. You know, they
oh, these are the KPIs. If you do these, wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, so the judges, they don't have it easy. I'm not saying they live in Shangri-La. I know get a tough job to do. And ultimately, they have to sign off on the fee petition. So I get it. But I've got to make a living, too.
Yeah.
And so do I ordinarily agree to the $7,200 cap? You damn right I do, because I'm also a small business person, and I've got to be... I've got to have my fees come in on a regular basis.
Right.
But in, let's say I go to federal court, I can get EJIA fees.
Right.
Can you get EJIA fees?
Yes, we do.
Okay, so Equal Access to Justice Act fees.
Okay.
If you win.
They're not very much, though.
Well, I think
what is
it's
the public defender it's, equivalent?
It's $241 an hour now.
Oh, okay.
So it's Equal Access to Justice Act, and if you win... Or if you can show the government's position was not substantially justified, how do you do that? You win.
You win.
If you win, then you submit a petition for EJIA fees to the federal court judge, and that's usually approved. Now, sometimes U.S. Attorney's Office, Office of General Counsel on the other side is going to fight you on that, but not really so much. Sometimes you have to go to a hearing.
I was
about
to say, do you get a settlement offer? Because that's what happens to us. They don't want
to
pay the EJIA fees. So they'll...
You talk to each other ahead of time. Well, you have to talk to each other ahead of time, right? Before you present it. So you talk to them, and 9 times out of 10, I can work it out with them. Sometimes I have to go to a hearing, and 95% of the time, the judge is going to pay those EJIA fees. And who pays the EJIA fees? We do, the American taxpayers. But it's not coming out of my client's retro.
Right.
So then if it gets remanded back to the judge and we're successful, once again, I can request a flat 25%. But the local ALJ only has approval to approve up to $12,000. So by that time, we're at 5, 6, 7 years.
And God.
And I either have to file a 406B motion and put it back in federal court, or I have to request approval with the regional administrative law judge in Atlanta, and that's 2 years to get approved. And
wow.
So yeah, it's not it's another part of the case. It's that much more work to get paid.
Just to get paid. That's
once
crazy.
You win.
That's
so
crazy.
It can be difficult.
You said you had another question you were going to ask before I cut you off about money.
Well, I did, but this kind of went in a different direction. I was just going to ask something like, let's say Leslie, right? If I lose my voice tomorrow, David, I don't think I have a job anymore. I won't have any clients.
You can get a different job.
Well, that is exactly where I'm going with this. Is there like and let's say Leslie had, my mom would, you know, let me sleep on the couch, I guess, forever. So I could prove that I've been unemployed for 12 months. Is there like an imputing of, hey, you could go be a grill girl again at Pollo Tropical?
Don't draw any unemployment benefits.
No,
as
no.
You're ready, willing, and able to
right,
work.
Right, 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 right.
So don't draw any unemployment benefits if you're totally disabled, because now you've got two contradictory signs for statements.
Oh, interesting.
Right?
Okay.
Now, they're not supposed to use that against you.
Sure.
Because they're supposed to recognize that people need money.
You need
and
money,
they're
yeah.
sign whatever, and but, oh, yeah, they'll use. I've had judges that'll say, okay, I'll pay it. Yeah, but when did they last receive the unemployment? Okay, the day after that.
Well, yeah, you're right, because to receive unemployment benefits, you're looking for a job,
you're
trying
willing
to get.
You're willing and able, and you can't get it.
Unless there's a medical exception. I've actually had clients surprise me and say, no, I got a medical exception. And so they were able to still get the benefit somehow, some way. I don't know how. But that's, I'm sorry, I cut you off.
So no, no. So I think you answered my question. There isn't so much of a, you know, you can't do this job anymore, but I can certainly go do the first job I ever had and cook chicken, apoyo de pigal.
Good question.
And flip the chicken on the grill. That doesn't require much talking.
You'd be the best grill master there is.
I'd be the best grill master ever.
Can't have a conversation
with your
co-op. Can't
talk to nobody. I'm very efficient.
Right.
You know, for all of $5.15 an hour, which is what they paid me.
Right. And they don't care how much you'll make. And they don't care if it was not, you know, if it's a status thing, they don't care. Any substantial gainful activity means any job in the local or national economy. It's, of course, a legal fiction. Any job that you could do, you could be a ticket taker at the movie theater, it could be anything. And one thing that's
interesting, but
the only difference is, now, if you're over age 50, over age 55, over age 60, then it becomes a lot easier for me to win your case. Why? Because we have what they call the medical vocational guidelines. So we're going to put you into a grid now, especially if you did unskilled work and heavy laborious work.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
That's where I'm going to win your case based on the grids all day long. Because even if you could do light or sedentary work, you're still considered disabled if you're not capable of doing your past relevant work. So
okay.
So what happens is you're, let's say, 50, you're closely approaching advanced age, 55, you're advanced age, 60, your advanced age, closely approaching retirement age.
Mm-hmm.
That threshold right there, that's a great case, because I have to prove you can't do your past work. All right, you're a construction worker. If you only have an 11th grade education, that's even better for me. So, and even if you have a high school education, that was like 30 years ago, right? So that's not going to help you, because it's not going to hurt you, because it doesn't provide for the ability to enter into skilled work tomorrow. So you prove that you can't do your past relevant work, and over age 55, 60, even if you could do light work, the ability to stand for 6 hours out of an 8-hour day, sit the remaining two, lift or carry 20 pounds occasionally. 20 pounds is still a case of water, right?
Yes.
That's not considered light work. Sedentary work, you flip it. The ability to, what we do, sit for 6 hours out of an 8-hour work day, stand or walk the remaining two, 10 pounds occasionally. Files, briefcase. Even if you can do sedentary or light work and you have that medical vocational profile, you had unskilled work, it doesn't transfer to other things, you're still considered disabled under the what we call the GRITs, the medical vocational guidelines.
Interesting.
Otherwise, under age 50?
At 40, I gotta go flip those chickens at Puerto Rico.
Yeah.
Got it.
I mean, especially with something like losing your voice. There's so many things that don't require you to talk. Plus, there's computers.
Oh, that is what, me losing my voice after I came back from a conference is what made me go get disability insurance. I was like, holy shit, this is the thing. This is the thing that's, I mean, I was like, and they had told me, like, the doctor was like, you have now nodules in your voice, in your vocal cords, and that you have to have surgery and stop talking, or they may never. And I was like, stop talking. I stopped talking. This place goes under, my friend. Like, there's no stop talking here.
But you have highly skilled past work experience, so they're going to say that there are other jobs that you can do. And
yeah.
Not the
least flipping
of
those chickens. Requires talking to nobody.
You could go be a legal brief writer.
Yeah.
Talk to nobody and flip those chickens.
Yeah, talk to nobody.
That was my first job.
That's right.
Flipping chickens.
You really do. All you do is stand there at that massive grill and flip the fucking chickens over and over again so they don't get overcooked. The less talking, the better.
What was your first job?
My first job? Construction.
Construction? What kind of construction?
pipe. My father was a
laying pipe
dirt contractor, so water, sewer, drainage pipe.
I was a civil engineer for 6 years. Water, sewer, paving, grading, drainage. It's yeah. all yeah.
That was my first job, and then law school and college. I was the first one in my family to go to college. My family were dairy farmers in New Hampshire, so my grandmother had 11 kids, and quite frankly, all my uncles are all self-made American success stories. They've all done really well for themselves. My dad was a construction guy, but I never knew that nobody went to college because everybody told me, you're going to college.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah.
Now, nobody told me how I was going to pay for it or what that meant. They just told me, you're going to college. So I went to college and then realized I had not saved enough money to get through sophomore, junior, senior year. So I went to work waiting tables at Chi-Chi's in Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Wow.
And let's see, I waited tables. And then I figured out that the money was in the booze.
Yes.
So I switched to the bar. I went behind the bar.
And that's a hard job.
Yeah.
Bartending is a hard job.
I was a bar back first. You know, you got to earn your chops before you can get behind. So I was
talk
a
about
bar back
lifting
first.
20 pounds. Yes.
Yeah. And then and law school, of course, you can't work your first year of law school. Like, you know, not supposed to, right? So I didn't work my first year of law school. I actually took a year off in between college and law school so I could save, because I, again, I had to pay for it.
Yeah.
So I took a year off. I saved. I ran out of money 1 week before finals, so I was eating a lot of pot pies.
Ramen noodles.
The pot pies of today.
Four for a dollar. Right? In Boston, you could get four for a dollar.
Pot pies are expensive here.
Yeah. I mean. No, they're so. Here, but no, but ramen noodles, 49 cents.
Yeah. And then second, third year, I attended bar in Boston for law school.
And how did you end up in this area of law, David? Because this is...
That's a good question.
I fell into it. This was not my chosen profession, not my chosen field within the law. Uh-huh. I was going to do maritime law.
Oh,
and
interesting.
That's actually what I did for the first 2 years of my career. I worked for Hayden & Milliken in the Gables. In the plumber building down the street. And that's what I wanted to do because I'm from New England. I'm from New Hampshire on the coast. Mm-hmm. And I was always amazed with the whole maritime industry. And so I was going to do maritime law. And I worked for a maritime firm for the first 2 years. And then my ex-wife took me to Virginia, where her family was from. And I ended up interviewing with this firm that was a workers' comp PI, Social Security Disability Mill. And they threw a lot of money at me to actually move. It was in the heart of the Appalachians.
Yeah.
I was in the mountains. Nothing could be further from, I was eight hours from the ocean. And they were very generous with their compensation package and paid for Florida Bar, the Virginia Bar. And my senior partner at the time was a really generous guy. After I took the Virginia Bar, he flew me down to Hilton Head in his private plane.
Oh, wow.
Handed me the keys to the Porsche and the condo on the ocean and said, take a week off. You've been studying hard. I need the Porsche back up in Virginia. So, you know, drive it back up. So they rolled out the red carpet for me. They treated me
that's
like
very
royalty.
Nice. Yeah.
And then once I had my Virginia bar license, they said, okay, here's 350 files. Figure out this security disability stuff. We hear there's a lot of money to be made in that. And, they were volume. So
yeah.
Somebody's going to pay for these commercials, David. Yeah. I mean.
Yeah, so that was 1992. I ended up, it just fell into it, you know.
Yeah.
And, then, and you were up there for how long?
I was up there for 4.5 years. And then once I knew this stuff inside and out, I started, I actually ran into a buddy of mine from law school. I went to Suffolk Law in Boston. And I ran into a buddy of mine from law school at one of these NOSCAR conferences in Charleston. And he said, wow, you've got a lot of experience. We're looking for a guy to open an office in Miami. And my dad lived in Pompano, and my mom lived in Sarasota. And I was always coming down to South Florida. And so this was 96. And, you know, South Beach was a lot different back then.
Yeah.
And
sure
you know,
was.
I'm pasty white, and I like Latin girls. So
So this was a good move.
So I discovered South Beach. And
it was a youthful move then.
Yeah, they said I could open an office in Miami. They wanted somebody to open an office, a satellite office in Miami. And so since I knew the law, I just had to figure out how to get the office up and running. And so that's how I ended up in Miami. And here I am.
And had to learn the business of law after knowing the...
Yeah, then I opened my shop March 1, 1999 because... Unfortunately, the people that brought me to Miami opened too many offices at the same time. They had sort of a national model where everything was centralized in Tampa.
Yeah.
And so, best intentions, the guy that brought me in, a great guy, but he just opened too many offices at the same time. He went way over. And he already had a Fort Lauderdale office. So the Fort Lauderdale guy, my buddy Glenn, and I were always working together. But once they decided to shut offices down, I was the new guy, and so they shut my office down first. And then I went to another firm in Fort Lauderdale. That turned out to be a nightmare. I turned around their Social Security Disability Department. That was an interesting twist, interesting take they had. It was a medical collections firm.
Hmm.
So. They would get all the contracts from all the hospitals to pay the bills, right? And they would try to get people qualified for Medicare and Medicaid. And if that didn't work and the person couldn't pay, they'd send it to their collections department. And I was in the background because if I won the Social Security disability case, they got qualified for Medicaid or Medicare, and so they get their bills paid.
Oh, right?
And so I worked for them for about a year and a half, and that didn't work out. And so March 1, 1999, I opened my own shop out of my apartment in South Beach. And
nice. Of course, you lived in an apartment in South Beach.
15th and Meridian, baby. 2 blocks from Lincoln Road.
I was going to say my first... Oh, my God. I know exactly where that is.
Yeah?
Yeah. When I first came to Miami, my first job was right there. Yeah. It was right there.
That's amazing.
And then New Year's Day 2001, I met my wife. She's from Peru. And... Now we're empty nesters. I've got 2 kids that just graduated from college, and we live in Miami Shores.
Tell me they're not going to law school, David. Tell me you've convinced them that's a bad idea.
My oldest is going to Boston. He's going to law school.
There's always one. There's always one you can't say.
Where in Boston has he decided? Yeah,
he hasn't decided yet. He's actually, again, taking a year off.
Yeah.
He wants to grind out the LSAT. He wasn't happy with the scores. He wants to do a lot better. And he said, don't take this the wrong way, Dad, but I think I can do better than Suffolk.
Ouch.
Yeah, he's got a good sense of humor. What are you going to do? You know?
Well, you know, if he needs some BU law connections, I'm right here.
Fantastic.
There you go.
Fantastic.
Well, thank you, Dave, for coming. We really appreciate you taking the time. Any final thoughts for our listeners or anything you want to add? Anything you want to say that you haven't already said?
No, I think I've spent enough of your time. But I appreciate you having me here. And what I will say is that, again, if you really do, I've been painting the picture of gloom and doom. it may not be the first 12 to 18 months. It may take 2 or 3 years. But there are a lot of people, when I put those time frames out, their response is, it doesn't matter. I don't have any choice.
Right.
I can't work. Yeah. I've paid into the system. I am entitled to these benefits. If it takes 2 years, 3 years, I'm there with you, and I tell them all the same thing. If you're willing to go there, then I'm willing to go there with you. So
that's a good.
There is some light at the end of the tunnel, and especially if I'm taking your case, then it's likely you're going to be okay, whether it be sooner or later.
Thank you so much. Thank you again. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again next time on Law Shit You Should Know.